Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Heritage Foods, an online and wholesale distributor of heritage breed meat and poultry. Learn more at heritagefoods.com.
I'm HRN's Communications Director Kat Johnson with a preview of this week's episode of Meat in Three.
I think we should realize that we more or less have a broken food system. When 800 million of us go to bed hungry, 600 million are obese, we waste 30% of our food, then something is fundamentally wrong.
We'll introduce you to one food waste solution happening in Asia.
They introduced this system where residents were issued an electronic ID card that would open an automated bin and enable them to weigh the food waste being dropped off. And then they would be charged, you know, in a certain amount of money for the weight of that food.
And we'll take a look at some of the real struggles happening closer to home.
How is it possible that a meal that was perfectly fine to consume at 10:59 p.m. then becomes waste at 11 p.m.
So tune in to this week's Meat in Three on Heritage Radio Network, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Is What Doesn't Kill You? Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and we are going to be talking about water again. I'm on a little tear about water and water systems around the country. I've covered some of the water problems in Miami. We talked to some people in North Carolina about the aftermath of Hurricane Florence and what that's done to water quality issues in that ag-heavy state. And today we're going to discuss water with a hydraulic engineer named Chris Jones. He's actually a research engineer at the University of Iowa's Institute of Hydraulic Research, Hydroscience, and Engineering Center. Thank you so much for joining me today on the show, Chris.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
So now you are the lead author on a recently published study, which was picked up by Civil Eats, and that's where I read about it first, in which you examined Iowa stream nitrate and the Gulf of Mexico. In other words, how farmland and agricultural runoff from Iowa contributes to the Gulf zone, the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, which by last estimates, I believe was some sort of 5,000 square miles. Am I correct in that?
Well, that's the goal, 5,000 square miles.
Oh, you mean because it's bigger now?
Well, I think this year it was around that, but the objective, the long-term objective is 5,000 square kilometers.
Okay.
Yeah. So that is measured as a five-year running annual average, and so last year we had a very large a dead zone, one of the biggest ever measured, and then this year it's quite a bit smaller.
And what would attribute that? What would contribute to its size growing? Is that because it rained a lot, and shrinking is because we have a drought?
Well, there's a lot of factors that contribute to Gulf of Mexico hypoxia. Of course, one we talk about a lot are these nutrients coming down the Mississippi River from the Midwestern Corn Belt, and of course, high nutrient levels in the Mississippi certainly increase the likelihood of a large dead zone. But then there's other climatic factors that figure in as well, including winds and temperature and cloudiness and these sorts of things. So,
nobody ever talks about that.
Yeah. So I think I've heard some things that perhaps some of this red tide in Florida maybe is perhaps related to the Mississippi River nutrients, but that's not something I'm real knowledgeable about.
Well, just to quickly and briefly tell you what I learned in speaking to people from the University of Miami, and that was that it's primarily overflow from the the dairy farms and also the corn industry, and it's because of the sort of diking system that they have going in and out of Lake Okeechobee, and and then into the Everglades, and they, you know, basically they've reduced all of the natural pathways that would normally absorb some of those nutrients, and that is contributing tremendously to what is a normally occurring phenomenon, which is red tide. But then it's complicated by this big cyanoalgae bloom as well that's coming through Okeechobee as a result of fertilizer runoff. There you have it in a nutshell. You can actually go back and listen to that.
they've changed their hydrology there just like we have here. So
we'll actually talk a little bit about how you've changed your hydrology in Iowa. Because this study actually covers about 11 years, am I right?
Actually, it's a little longer than that, 1999 to 2016. Right. And to address the first part of that, you know, Iowa, before Europeans got here, was mainly wet prairie and wetlands. And, you know, to maximize production of corn and soybeans, we've lowered the water table by installing these drainage tiles.
Right.
And so that's a network of pipes, network of porous pipes that are about a meter down in farm fields, and that lowers the water table, as I said, and it enhances conditions for corn and soybean production. And so we know, and we've known for a long time, that this constructed drainage system is the primary delivery mechanism for nitrate from farm fields to the stream network. And so Iowa, the landscape is a much drier place now than it was 150 years ago.
Yeah, sure sounds like it. And that could be a problem going forward as we heat up, I imagine, right?
That's right. And so as we drain and we dry out the soils, we actually have seen an increase in rainfall here in Iowa, especially over the last 40 to 50 years. And so it's much wetter now in terms of the amount of precipitation that we get. And so farmers respond to that by improving the drainage infrastructure in their fields. And so it's a bit of a vicious circle, if you will. You know, the drainage is what moves the nitrate, and we respond to more rainfall with more drainage, and then, of course, we get more nitrate.
Yes, that's a problem. So let's just go back for a second to the study. A 17-year-long study in which you made this, you know, an examination of these cycles that were going on. Let me ask you, I always like to know, who commissioned the study? Who paid for the study? Like, how did this happen?
So I work in what's called IIHR, Hydroscience and Engineering, and we have a real diverse source of funding. And so some of this was funded. The graduate student, Jacob Nielsen, who's the second author, his time here was largely funded through the Iowa Nutrient Reduction Strategy, or the Iowa Nutrient Reduction Center, I should say. Uh-huh. But we have various sources of funding, and so no one actually commissioned the study. This is just a graduate project that Jacob was assigned by his thesis advisor, which was Larry Weber, so that's it. It's not a commissioned study.
I see. And so given the politics of water in Iowa, with which I'm quite familiar because I've interviewed Bill Stowe numerous times on this program about his suit against the Upper River counties. And I saw that actually you had put in some time as a hydraulic superintendent at the Des Moines Water Works. Is that right?
Well, I supervise the laboratory there.
Yeah, supervise the lab. I was just like glancing through your CV real quick and I saw that. So how did the report go down? Like how did the farmers respond to this report, which basically says that they're killing the Gulf of Mexico?
Well, you know, we've known for quite a while about hypoxia and the triggers and what causes it, and so I think we just with the paper we helped characterize that a little bit better and Iowa's role in the hypoxic zone. A lot of times people do ask me whether or not I've encountered hostility about this and other work. And the answer is I really don't. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't interact with farmers a lot. I do some.
Sure.
But, you know, the reactions aren't hostile, but there is, you know, a lot of the instinct here is to really default to the weather as the cause of this.
Oh, really?
And so, you know, when we saturate the landscape with a water-soluble pollutant like nitrate, it stands to reason when we get more rain, more of that's going to make it to the streams. But, you know, we know we have two factors here that control nitrate delivery, and those two things can be grouped into transport limitations and supply limitations. And, of course, we've greatly increased the supply of nitrate here on the landscape that's vulnerable to loss through our drainage infrastructure and then through our farming practices. And mm-hmm. then when the rain comes along, it's going to, you know, it's going to dissolve that and move it. So,
you know, when you were making, you know, doing this study, you guys were focusing on the delivery of all this runoff to the Gulf of Mexico. But what about the impact on local riparian systems? In other words, like I noticed, I've been to Des Moines several times now. And although I noticed this most recent time that it was a lot better, but normally speaking, the river smells horrible. And I know from Bill Stowe of the Des Moines Water Works that the water quality in the city is very poor, and that many millions of dollars have been spent in trying to remedy that. So when farmers think about that, I mean, I know you're not a farmer and you don't interact with them that much, but I mean, how do you convey that this is not just an impact on a faraway place like the Gulf of Mexico, but it's an impact on your neighbors? Is there any way to make
So that's a good question, and that gets discussed a lot, in that this hypoxia problem is a distant sort of thing, and you know it's not something that many people really are aware of. I don't think I heard a fisherman or a shrimper from Louisiana say once that most of the fishermen down there are aware of hypoxia, but even they aren't very knowledgeable about what causes it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, we do have local effects on water quality. And so we have, in Iowa, I think we have about 100 natural lakes that were formed by glaciers, and many of those are impaired because of runoff into them, nitrogen and phosphorus runoff into them. We have maybe about the same number of constructed lakes,
uh-huh.
and those tend to be impaired even more severely because, you know, those have a stream that runs through them. It's their flow-through systems, and so consequently they get a lot of nutrient delivery, and so we do have effects on our lakes that algae blooms in the summertime, and then streams, like you say, in Des Moines, the Raccoon and Des Moines rivers both can have algae blooms, and they those are used as a source of drinking water.
Yeah.
And so with elevated nitrate in the drinking water, in the source water, the utility there has to remove nitrate. And I think there's about 60 communities in Iowa that have issues with nitrate. Either they're removing it or their system is threatened by high levels.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, we do have local issues related to water quality here, and not just the nutrients, also sediment and some other things. And those issues do tend to hit home a little bit, you know, better or a little bit they're more apparent than Gulf of Mexico hypoxia. And so, yes, we do talk about these things in the context of both the regional issues and then the local issues.
Right. And then, so what is the, you know, I've understood from Bill Stowe and from actually other farmers in Iowa, strangely enough, I speak to quite a few of them, mm-hmm. but they, you know, they all have complained about the fact that the state It always seems to be very firmly in the pocket of the larger agricultural concerns, you know, the big soy farmers, the big corn farmers, which aren't even really farmers so much as they are big corporations at this point. I mean, it's not, you know, these aren't just, you know, mom and pop and they're farming, you know, 500 acres. These are tens of thousands of acres under cultivation. And so that entity has had quite a silencing effect, both on Bill Stowe and his quest for cleaning up the water system and getting ratepayers to pay for a new water filtration system, which is what is required, as I understand it, in Des Moines and probably in other places. Like, do you play politics at all, Chris, or is that you're just like you're
no,
just the facts,
no,
man?
No, I can't afford to do that. But,
right.
You know, the idea that that these are big corporate farms is sort of true. But in Iowa, we do have some laws about land ownership. And when you look at the number of farmers that we have, which is about 90,000, I think, mm-hmm. and the number of acres that are farmed, which is about 24 million, and you do that math, you know, that's only about 400 to 500 acres per farmer.
Right.
Now, some farmers are farming thousands of acres.
Yeah.
And we do have these LLCs set up that, you know, can be several family members, for example, brothers, cousins, mm-hmm. wives, and so forth, where they are farming a lot of acres. But, you know, this nutrient issue, I mean, it does connect to the size of the farms a little bit, but I don't see that as the primary driver here. It's just this corn-soybean system is really vulnerable to leaking nitrogen to the drainage infrastructure, and that's true whether we're talking about 40 acres or whether we're talking about 4,000 acres.
Sure. Right. Now, your study only measured the impact of corn-soy agriculture, row cropping, on water. What about, I mean, I know it's not included in this, but I'm just curious about the hog waste issues, because obviously Iowa is home to many, many hogs and much hog waste as a result. And I know that that is also an infrastructural problem that hasn't been adequately dealt with. Do you have any opinion on that, or is that just sort of like not even part of this picture in terms of the hypoxia down, you know, flowing downstream?
Yeah. So I do have another paper submitted that looks at animal waste that's in review. And, you know, we've always had a lot of hogs here.
Yeah.
And, but what's changed is that, you know, the concentration. And so I don't know if I'm quoting the numbers exactly, but I think in 1982 we had about 65,000 farmers that had hogs. And the total number of hogs was about 14 million hogs.
Uh-huh.
And 20 years later, we had 10,000 farmers, and we still had 14 million hogs. And
yeah.
So the hogs have been concentrated in, you know, on a few farms, and those farms that have hogs are very likely to be concentrated in certain areas of the state.
Right.
And so one is in northwest Iowa. There's an area concentration in north central Iowa, and then we have an area in southeast Iowa. And so in those areas, in those counties, I do think that the concentration of hogs and also cattle, uh-huh. which is northwest Iowa, has had an effect on water quality, and especially in maybe some of these streams flowing to the Missouri River.
Uh-huh.
And so we've got another paper in review, as I said, that looks at that. And I do think it's an issue, but more of a localized issue and not, you know, a statewide one.
Yes. Okay. Except that, I mean, could one extrapolate? I mean, you and I will be talking about that paper when it publishes, my friend. that's a promise, not a threat.
Okay.
Yeah.
You got to get accepted.
I'm trusting in your scholarship. I am. What I was going to say is, would there be lessons to be learned from your experiences in Iowa, both in the row cropping aspects and in the animal waste aspects, that could be applied to other states that are similarly? I'm thinking of North Carolina specifically, because they're also a big row cropping state, although they don't grow the same as you, but they grow a whole lot of hogs there. And, you know, obviously, I'm sure you've been following their problems with, you know, the breaches of lagoons and the way they don't manage their waste and the various lawsuits that have happened and so forth. And I know that in Iowa right now, there's an ongoing lawsuit against a company that wants to open another big CAFO. Is it Jefferson County? Does that sound right to you? It's my friend Francis Tickey who alerted me to that.
He does live in Jefferson County.
Yeah, so somebody is trying to build another really large hog facility, and his county is fighting against it. And largely, I think, because of the nuisance issues, such as water quality impacts and air quality. We're going to take a quick break right now for a sponsor drop, and we'll be right back with Chris Jones, a research engineer at the University of Iowa's Institute of Hydraulic Research, Hydroscience, and Engineering Center, to talk more about water quality issues in Iowa.
This episode is brought to you by Heritage Foods. Heritage Foods was founded to sell ancient breeds of livestock and poultry that were becoming extinct, largely because industrial agriculture willfully pushed healthy heritage breeds aside for more profitable, faster-growing animals. Rare heritage breeds are saved when popular demand increases and farmers have the incentive to raise them. This Thanksgiving, we encourage you to buy a turkey from Frank Reese's Good Shepherd Poultry Ranch. Frank's turkeys are 100% purebred heritage, 100% pasture-raised, and 100% antibiotic-free. Turkeys are available in 2-pound increments. You choose your size. Don't wait. Pre-order your Heritage Thanksgiving turkey today at heritagefoods.com.
I was reading in a very recently published paper by the United States Geological Survey, circular number 1437, Understanding the Influence of Nutrients on Stream Ecosystems in Agricultural Land. I understood this paper to be saying essentially that tile drainage, the system of tile drainage, is in fact adding to, as you, in fact, you just confirmed this, adding to the nutrient runoff, because in the natural riparian system of streams and creeks and stuff like that, there are, you know, stream beds and there are curves that all tend to trap more of the nutrients as they flow through. And so what I'm understanding from this paper is that, in fact, the whole tile drainage system sucks. In fact.
So there's two things to consider here in terms of the hydrology. One is the streams, as you say, have been straightened and what we call incised. And so many of our streams in Iowa have been incised. And so that they took the meanders out of them, you know, 100 years ago. You know, so they wouldn't have to turn corners going around these streams to farm, and then it made them easier to levee too. You know, so we channelize these streams, and so yes, when the nitrate gets in the stream, it doesn't get consumed as well by the aquatic life in that stream, because the biodiversity of the stream has been greatly degraded by this stream incision. So that's one thing.
Okay.
The second thing is, you know, when you look at a drop of rain, when it fell on the landscape in Iowa, how long would it take for that drop of rain to get to the stream network? And so in some of these watersheds in Iowa, that number would have been in the centuries. So that drop of rain would have taken a very long time to seep through the soil profile and through the aquifers and out through the shallow alluvial aquifers in the rivers. And in some of these watersheds, as I said, that may have been as long as, say, 200-300 years, or maybe even longer.
Wow.
Now, with tile drainage and other modifications, conversion of a perennial prairie system to annual crops, you know, that now is been changed to on the order of days to maybe 2 years in some of these systems. And so we greatly hasten the flow of water from the landscape to the streams.
Uh-huh.
So some of these nutrients otherwise would get consumed, you know, in the trip there as that water traveled. But now it goes so fast, the water gets delivered to the stream network so fast that there's no opportunity for microorganisms or plant roots or anything like that to grab onto it and sequester it and use it before it gets to the stream network. So the altered hydrology here is a huge issue. And so a lot of times we just look at fertilization practices and what the farmers are doing, but the average person doesn't realize how much this altered hydrology is a factor here.
And so, Chris, like if say they're, you know, I don't see anyone not farming corn and soy anytime soon, like, you know, at least in the next 10 or 15 years, I don't see that profile changing in Iowa. So that means that you have another 10 or 15 years of this amount of runoff or more, because as the soil becomes more depleted, I think it's fair to say that they have to apply more fertilizer, right?
Yes.
What is the answer here? Like how, I know you guys have a nutrient, Iowa nutrient reduction plan, and you were going to try to hit a 45% reduction target by this year or something. What are the prospects for that happening? And more importantly, what are solutions? Like what are other methods? You've done the hydrology, you've changed the stream beds, you've added the tile drainage. You can't really back out of that so easily. So is it just about changing farming practices vis-a-vis fertilizer, or is there some other method that you can envision that could be implemented that would have that?
So, yes, we have the nutrient reduction strategy, and the objective was to reduce nutrient loading 45%. There was not a date set for that, so it's open-ended. But the 45% is consistent with the objectives for the Gulf of Mexico hypoxic zone. So how do we get there in this corn-soy system? And we know that's a really difficult thing to accomplish. And so the practices that we have that are approved for state cost-share dollars are what we call edge-of-field practices, which are things like wetlands that intercept the tile water before it gets to the stream network. We also have what we call saturated buffers, where the tile water is intercepted underground in the riparian area of the stream. And then we have wood chip bioreactors, which are just sort of little miniature treatment plants for the tile water to consume nitrate. Then we also have infield practices that the farmers can use. And then one thing that we're really kind of looking to as a silver bullet here is cover crops. And so cover crops are things like cereal, rye, or radishes, or some other plants that the farmers plant near the end of the corn-soy growing season.
Yeah.
And they grow in the fall. They have a significant growth in the fall. And they sequester some water and some nutrients and prevent that nutrient loss. And so we feel like we need maybe 50 to about 70% of our acres in Iowa in cover crops, and you know we only have 3% right now. So,
wow.
You know, it's really a long row to hoe here. And we know this is just going to be a really expensive thing to solve this in the corn-soy system. It's probably $1 billion-a-year problem just in Iowa.
Oh my gosh!
And to get there, and you know, we're not investing anywhere near that amount of money right now.
Well, that leads me to the question, which was brought up in the Civil Eats article that you were quoted in, which was the impact of two programs that are currently in the Farm Bill, and are at least one of them is being considered to be folded into another one with essentially some loss of finances. One of them is the Conservation Stewardship Program, which I think a lot of my listeners certainly are familiar with, which does encourage farmers to do exactly the measures that you've been discussing, you know, buffer zones, cover crops, et cetera. And then there's another thing called EQIP, I guess, EQIP, that they're talking about folding the Conservation Stewardship Program into the EQIP program, and that would somehow address the farmers' needs in terms of financial incentives and or investments in making these changes to their practices. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about those programs and whether they are the answer in a way, or whether it's going to require something much more draconian.
So I know something about this, but I should emphasize that, you know, I'm not an authority on the farm programs.
Understood.
And I don't certainly don't speak for the industry on that. But yeah, CSP and EQIP, I think the total outlay was about $1 billion in 2007, and that's about $2.7 billion currently. Mm-hmm. And those two comprise about half of all the federal expenditures on farm conservation. And so EQIP provides cost share to farmers to help them comply or avoid regulation. And so that, you know, a lot of that's been directed to the livestock industry because of that. CSP is more of a thing where farmers get multi-year contracts for conservation stewardship and practices that perhaps benefit the long-term productive capacity of that farm, but also provide some environmental benefit.
Right.
So as I understand it, and I think you mentioned this, the House Farm Bill would take CSP down to zero and sort of fold it into EQIP, which would increase to about $3 billion by 2028. So the thing here, though, is the House bill shifts the CSP contracting authority to EQIP, but the crop stewardship activities is limited to a maximum of 50% of the total budget authority provided to EQIP. This would result in at least a $5 billion reduction over 10 years in the funds available for the working land stewardship.
Uh-huh.
And so the effect of this, firstly, another big change is that these irrigation districts in drier parts of the country would be able to compete for these EQIP dollars for water efficiency projects, which they aren't currently.
Uh-huh.
So what this means essentially is that if this were to pass, if the House version were to pass, more of this money would go towards southern areas that are growing cotton and rice and peanuts, and to these irrigated regions, you know, to the west and southwest of Iowa. And so this would sort of be most likely be at the expense of people farming corn and soybeans here in the Midwest. And so potentially, you know, this could help some farmers in other places, south and southwest of here, but like Iowa farmers, and, you know, it might be at the expense of their conservation dollars, which certainly would not help in terms of these Mississippi River Basin issues.
Mm-hmm. I guess, I mean, I want to wrap this up because I realize my program is so nerdy and so long, and I just get such a deep dive because I'm so interested in this stuff. But other people perhaps do not have the same tolerance as I do. Anyway, I want to pull back for a second, Chris, and look at this as a macro problem, because Iowa is not operating in a vacuum. These are issues that are coming up in state after state. In your report alone, you mentioned Kansas and Missouri and Illinois as other states that are coping with the same issues regarding cropping, like corn, soy, but especially corn. So looking as a hydrologist or a hydraulic engineer, looking at the nation as a whole, how are we going to dig our way out of this problem before we really essentially run out of drinking water for big population centers?
Well, you know, the story of American agriculture going back to the 1930s is it's sort of a victim of its own success in that, you know, it's produced more than what we need. And you know, that has consequences all over the place in terms of economics and then also the environment. And, you know, at least for soybeans, we've been able to develop these foreign markets, which have been able to absorb our production here. And then we've had the ethanol industry that also has been able to absorb all our production for corn. And now, you know, the economics of all that is changing a little bit. And so we know that these diverse farms, at least in terms of nutrients, do not have the nutrient loss that a strictly corn-soybean rotation has. We know that.
Yeah.
And so when they put other things in rotation like oats or alfalfa or wheat or what have you, that very likely, you know, can reduce nutrient loss from those acres. Now, how do you make that work economically for the farmer? And so, you know, Iowa used to be the number one oats producing state, and, you know, now we're not even close. And a farmer's not going to grow oats if he doesn't have some place to sell them.
Sure.
And so I think the ultimate answer here is, how do we create some diversity on these farms? You know, we went from a system, a perennial system that had hundreds of species, and that being the prairie and the wetlands, and we condense that down to a system with two species that are both annuals, corn and soybeans, and then we want that system to produce environmental outcomes and that, you know, that are favorable for recreation and drinking water and angling and these sorts of things. And so sometimes I think our expectations are maybe not right. And so we know that diversity is good all over the place in nature, and we know that these diverse farms are likely to deliver fewer nutrients to the Gulf, but how do we get there and how do we make it work economically?
Yeah. And how do we move the political, how do we move the politics towards that? Because all I see from where I'm sitting is, you know, industrial interests that are aggregated firmly against changing the status quo, whether it's lobbying organizations on behalf of large corn and soy producers, or whether it's, you know, the meat industry lobbying for their interests. You know, it seems a very heavy lift to get any of these, you know, industries to, you know, function on some kind of vaguely altruistic level.
Sure. So that's why I think it's a mistake sometimes to just look to the farmer for this stuff.
Oh, totally.
Because these big companies, you know, they want to advertise products being produced sustainably.
Yeah.
And they want to put a green stamp on it, but they don't want to shoulder the burden.
Right.
For the costs associated with that.
And they don't want to put that money in the farm bill. They don't, you know, they don't,
right.
The politicians don't want to put the money in the farm bill because then they won't get the campaign contributions from these larger organizations. It's a big problem.
So, yeah. So here in Iowa, yeah, we had this lawsuit and everybody's mad at each other. But we expect nothing from the people buying these commodities. We expect nothing from these companies in the context of water quality and air quality. And so here we are, we're exploiting our natural resources, and, you know, the users of the products really bear no burden for the consequences. And so that's where I think we need to be careful before we have a knee-jerk reaction to the farmer and what they're doing, because, you know, they are locked into a system here a little
Yes.
bit.
Yes. I'm entirely sympathetic to the plight of the farmer. I mean, I know, you know, very well after 10 years of doing this show, I get how, you know, risk-averse you need to be, how risky your life is being a farmer, how much work it takes, and also the way the market drives farming or agricultural concerns in this country. I'm pretty hip to that. So, you know, my feeling is, like, in terms of, like, hog waste, I think the big, you know, meat companies like Tyson and Smithfield et al., that they have an obligation to put waste reduction strategies into place in their contract farmers' locations that completely absolve the farmer of, you know, any financial necessity to cope with those problems that they are essentially creating by aggregating pigs in that way. Did I make that clear? In other words, I think the companies should be in charge of waste production. I think the companies that are making the big bucks on these crops should be in charge, should be financially responsible for maintaining water and air quality. That's my feeling.
Well, we all have responsibilities here, and as consumers as well. And, you know, I think this, you know, if we want a sustainable system and we want these amenities that come along with clean water and recreation and all that stuff, these are huge, enormous problems. You know, the whole wicked problem thing, that's what this is.
Yeah.
It's going to take an effort by everybody involved in the whole value chain. And yes, the farmers are the ones that are closest to the production of the commodities, but still, everybody that uses those commodities has to recognize that they're part of this.
Absolutely. Like, I will pay more money. I will pay more money if I know that my extra 5 cents on the dollar or whatever it is going towards, repairing or otherwise improving water quality in farm country where people are. I know that people are being adversely impacted by this. I know that there are towns in Kansas where they all drink bottled water because they don't have enough money municipally to create a wastewater treatment plant that actively and adequately removes the nutrients from their agricultural world. I mean, you know.
And, you know, we know here in Iowa there's been polls conducted that really show that Iowa citizens are willing to pay for clean water. They're willing to pay.
Yeah.
So, you know, how do we get there? How do we create systems that deliver the outcomes that we want? And yes, these farm bill programs are important, and we hate to lose them, but we also have to recognize that the existing programs haven't gotten us to where we want to be.
Interesting.
And this is it's a huge, enormous problem.
It's a lift. It's an educational process that you are actively engaged in. I'm going to wrap it up there, and thank you so much for joining me today, Chris. Do let me know when that when your paper is accepted about hog waste management. I'm fascinated. I wrote a book about the meat industry. That was one of my favorite subjects. Anyway, thanks a lot for listening. Thanks so much to my sponsor. And I recognize that we'll have to do a little editing post-show so that we can add that break in the center for my sponsor drop. Thanks for listening, folks. See you next time. So long, Chris.
Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening. Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves.
And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Alweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.